This is the Fig City News Podcast. I'm Jack Pryor. Today we're joined by Jason Poulos, who's running for the Democratic primary for the Massachusetts 4th Congressional District. Jason, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Jack.
So before we start, a quick disclosure. I endorsed Congressman Auchincloss when he first ran in 2019, before Fig City News existed. And we also interviewed him on the podcast in January outside the context of the campaign, and we'll offer him a follow-up as well if he's interested coming off of this. So I wanted to get started. Just tell us about yourself. Go back as far back in your history and work up to the present, deciding to run for Congress.
Great. Well, thanks for having me on, Jack. So I grew up in the district. I grew up in Sherburn, Massachusetts. I'm a product of public education. I went to Dover Sherburn Regional High School. I went to UMass Amherst, and then I went to UC Berkeley to get my PhD in political science and computational science and engineering. And I came back to Massachusetts to do two postdocs, one in data science at Harvard Medical School. And that was in the intersection of causal inference and AI. And the second postdoc in AI and health policy at Brigham and Women's Hospital. And that was in predicting diabetes treatment outcomes using electronic health records and AI methods. And so I decided to run for Congress because, I'm really concerned about how AI is affecting the workplace in particular. And I don't see many people in Congress right now who are, I think, sufficiently concerned about the structural impacts of artificial intelligence on our workforce. And so, for instance, it's projected that 50,000 jobs last year were laid off due to AI, and about 7% of the entire workforce will be laid off in the next decade. And so we need large structural changes to create a floor for workers. And I'm a big proponent of Medicare for All, so decouple health insurance with employment. And so if a worker is displaced by AI, they don't have to worry about losing their health insurance. Universal basic income to provide a income floor for every adult in this country. And to expand collective bargaining rights to ensure that all workers in this country have power to decide how AI is deployed in their workforces. And so I'm also a big proponent of the PRO Act to strengthen collective bargaining rights in this country. And in order to implement these large structural changes, we have to get big money out of politics. And so that's why I'm also pushing for ending Citizens United, which was the disastrous Supreme Court decision that unleashed the floodgate of unlimited PAC spending in our elections.
Mm-hmm. So your fundraising so far is about mm-hmm. Through the end of March is mm-hmm. around 91,000, with about 5,000 coming from yourself. Mm-hmm. You've had people drop out of the race for lack of resources. What's your plan through the rest of the campaign to address the $7 million that Congressman Auchincloss has?
Yes. So a few things. I would just highlight that the average donation that we're receiving is $32. And we're receiving a lot of reoccurring donations, so small dollar donations, like $10. People are donating $10, $5 every month. So I would just say that this model of grassroots support, I think, is the way forward in our elections, because if elected, I will go to Congress representing the people of this district. 84% of all the donations that we've received is from individuals in mm-hmm. this district. Mm-hmm. And I think it contrasts with the other model in which politicians are receiving a lot of support from corporations and special interest groups, and they go to Congress and they're kind of beholden to these interests. And so I think the grassroots approach is the way to go, and I think that's what voters in this district are asking for.
You mentioned collective bargaining rights. Mm-hmm. Do you see unionization going beyond towards white collar workers more, or technical workers more than it has in the past, given the situation?
So I think it should. I think, there's a push. There's an underground economy of data labelers, data annotators, who are helping to build these AI models. And these are people who, are working on contract, who aren't receiving health insurance, who don't have like any power in their workforce. And I think there's an opportunity there in this sector of the economy, which is, one of the fastest growing employment sectors, to organize. And so I do think that unionization can grow beyond blue collar work. It could go into these new growing sectors of the economy, such as data annotation.
I wanted to dive a little bit into your background in AI. It's certainly a topic people are interested in. Can you talk a little bit about the work you've done there, particularly around benchmarking large language models?
Yeah. So I can start with that. So the last research paper that I worked on was with a group in Stanford, and we just published a paper. It's out in the ICLR, which is one of the top AI journals, and it's called Terminal Bench. And what it is, it's a collection of tasks that are real world tasks written by experts. And the point is to benchmark frontier AI models, like how well they do in terminal desktop tasks. So like you open your terminal, you ask AI model to perform a task. Can it do that task? Can it pass the tests? And so this is important because we're in an era where these frontier models are rapidly developing, and we don't know exactly how fast they're developing. And so we need these benchmarks to basically keep track of of how well they're doing over time, and also what are the faults of these models, like where do they break down in these tasks. So I've submitted a few tasks from my like work background, my academic research background, having to do with the biomedical sciences and life sciences, and so this research is interesting because we can have kind of like a pulse on both the development of frontier AI models and like also what their weaknesses are.
Right. I mean, I'm curious. I guess I work a little bit in my day job with AI, and I've heard people say, two or three years ago, at a major university, they expected this to, it's kind of a fad, to kind of plateau, that everything plateaus. Are you seeing that now? Are you seeing diminishing returns? Are the benchmarks show accelerating exponential growth?
Right.
And is that because the benchmarks aren't capturing what they can do, or is it really accelerating as it codes itself?
So the pace of AI model development is actually exceeding the pace of frontier of benchmark development. And so the Terminal Bench project that I was working on, it was a open source, like experts from across the world were contributing to it. I also contributed to another benchmark called Humanity's Last Exam, which was like one of the first kind of expert level benchmark data sets that all the new frontier models test against. And what we see, the AI performance on those benchmarks are definitely ascending over time, and in such a way that there's saturation, which means that the AI models are scoring well over 50% on these expert level data sets. And so and there's this new model called Mythos, which is there's been like limited previews of it that have well outperformed previous models and are kind of outgunning these benchmark data sets. So,
all right. And again, I don't want to go too deep into it, but this is your space, and I have some curiosity about it. I mean, with AGI, everyone said, "Oh, we're moving towards AGI." Are we at the point where people would have said it was AGI already, or what is the threshold that gets declared in your?
So I think with AGI, like artificial general intelligence, the thing that AI models now can't develop hypotheses the way that scientists can, and they can't, they don't have the kind of scientific intuition, and I don't think they have the capability of really proposing new scientific questions. And that's really, to me, the forefront of what intelligence means. And so that's why it's still, you know, human intelligence is very important, and it's going to remain to be important, because AI models, I think, lack the creativity in designing and proposing new hypotheses. I think humans are still useful now.
Yeah, I just, I mean, in the past, there was a Turing test, which kind of ChatGPT, you know, blows through, and so I was curious if the, you know, if the threshold is clear that people are looking at, I should know it. I guess I'm looking a little bit at your platform. You've talked a little bit about automation taxes or AI taxes. Can you describe more of the policy you would want to propose on that front?
Right. And there are international models in this, like South Korea has a kind of automation tax. In the Senate, Bernie Sanders has proposed a so-called robot tax, which would impose a tax on corporations if they decide to automate. And you know, one of the uses for that would be to help pay for something like a universal basic income. So right now in Congress, there's legislation called the Boost Act that would provide $250 a month to every adult in this country. And the Boost Act is paid by a tax on households earning. It goes up to 150, you get a net benefit, and over that you pay into the system. I think it could be structured a different way, such as a corporate tax on automation could fund a UBI. Other people have proposed like a token tax. So if LLMs, they use tokens, and the larger the LLM, the more tokens they use. And maybe we should impose like a tax on token usage, which is also, you know, leads to greater energy output, which, you know, is being socialized now on
a lot of adverse
rate payers, right?
Uncovered, what's the term? It's externalities
right.
to it, you know? And then I guess in terms of job loss, you talked about it a little bit before, like how quickly do you see this coming and to what extent? I mean, is it 5 years out? Is it gonna 2 years out? Is there a spiral? There was an article published a couple months ago about a hypothetical spiral where job loss leads to cause trouble with companies, which leads them to lay off more, and we end up in bad shape by 2028, or I forget the date that was involved. How quickly do you see it moving?
We're already seeing layoffs due to AI. And, you know, so Oracle just announced, I think a week or two ago, that about 20,000 of their workforce would be laid off. And the reason why they didn't say because of AI automation, they said it's because, you know, human labor is no longer as valuable to us. We're profitable and we're a growing company, but we want to invest our resources in AI data centers. Now, you know, AI data centers now are unregulated by the federal government. We have no idea how much energy output they're using. We have no idea how much water they're using. We have no idea the environmental consequences, the health consequences. So this is an entirely unregulated development. And so what Oracle said was, we want to invest our earnings in AI data centers and not in expanding our workforce. And there are other sectors that are replacing workers with robots such as, you know, the dock workers in California. And so they're, you know, striking and unionizing around that issue. And so I do think that there is going to be significant job loss. Like, there is a McKinsey report that said 7% of the workforce would be laid off within the next decade. Mm-hmm. I don't know what, like, you know, how rapidly that's going to come. I think some of the predictions from the company heads are kind mm-hmm. of, I think, might be too pessimistic. Mm-hmm. But
how do you think the companies will make the trade-off between human and AI labor if they can accomplish a task for $100,000 a year with a human? And what's the number that they switch to automation? Is it 99,000? Is it 90,000? How do you think people? It's almost like offshoring. You know, how those trade-offs are made. Any thoughts on that?
So I don't. I think, I mean, it's hitting industries that are code development, code dependent. So like software developers, that sort of thing. And so, you know, I think like the workforce in some of these sectors are going to be devoted to overseeing AI deployment rather than doing work itself. Mm-hmm. Right. And there's also a lot of other industries in which, you know, there's not as much, you know, prospect for automation.
Right. You mentioned health consequences of data centers. Can you speak to that at all? I've seen one or two things on that front, but what are you thinking of specifically?
Right. So there are a few things. One thing is that the water usage is significant. So like GPUs need water to cool and so there have been reports of, you know, drying up well water. I can't speak to like specific other health consequences, but you can kind of imagine our large data center that's drying up people's wells and creating a lot of emissions. There might be some like carcinogenic effects of.
I've heard things about like low frequency vibration or something on that front, but I don't know if it's speculative or real. All right. Anything else? I mean, we can pivot back a little bit more to your campaign and the other issues that are in Congress. Anything else to cover on the AI front that you'd like to speak to?
Not on the top of my mind. Yeah.
All right. So maybe step back again, and you covered it quickly at the beginning, but sort of your key, I guess, talking points on your campaign in terms of platform and policy. Maybe just run through those again and we can double click on those if it makes sense.
Yeah, so the main thing is Medicare for All. And so as a country, we're spending more than most other developed nations. We still have 27 million people uninsured. And our health outcomes as a ratio of the amount of money we spend on healthcare is actually one of the lowest among industrialized nations. And so I think everyone would agree that our current health system is broken. You know, I believe the way forward is Medicare for All, which would move us towards a single payer system. It's estimated that Medicare for All would save about $450 billion a mm-hmm. year. The CBO actually estimates $650 billion a year. And that's principally due to the fact that the cost savings of Medicare for All is about 8% overhead versus a 20% overhead in mm-hmm. private health insurance.
Okay.
And so, you know, I think that's really, I thought it was an important policy, before the emergence of AI. And I think it's even more important now because, we're in a situation where, workers' jobs can be automated away and, losing your healthcare as a consequence of losing your job is, disastrous. And, it should be, you know, our number one priority. And day one, if I'm elected, I will co-sponsor the Medicare for All Act, which has significant support among the Democratic caucus. I do believe it's something that we could pass, next legislative congressional session if the Democrats take the House and the right Democrats win their primaries this year.
Right, right. All right. Any other issues top of mind?
So another issue I talk a lot about is overturning Citizens United. Mm-hmm. And so there's an amendment in Congress right now called the Citizens Over Corporations Amendment. And before this, it was called the Democracy for All Amendment. And it's a Jim McGovern amendment, which would initiate the constitutional process to overturn Citizens United. So it would kick it to the states, and I think 38 states would have to approve it through constitutional amendments, and then it becomes enshrined in constitutional law that, in fact, corporations are not people, and Congress does, in fact, have the authority to set limits on political spending. So what the Supreme Court had ruled was that Congress could not set limits on corporation spending money. And it also loosened the amount that individuals could spend.
Do you think is there bipartisan support for that? You probably would need Citizens United to apply to the campaign to get rid of you need to take Citizens United out of the campaign to get rid of Citizens United to have it succeed in this environment. But is it a bipartisan thought, or would it divide on party lines,
so
red, blue?
It could definitely pass the House if the Democrats could take control. So Representative Auchincloss does not support the constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United, even though he says he opposes Citizens United. So that's why I say it's important to elect the right kind of Democrats, because in next legislative session, Democrats can set the agenda, and they can set an agenda that includes passing Medicare for All, that includes passing the PRO Act, and that includes initiating the constitutional process to overturn Citizens United.
So maybe that's a good pivot to maybe contrast your views and approach to Congressman Auchincloss. Where would you see yourselves most misaligned or unaligned, I guess, on a philosophy or approach? I mean, I guess you could speak to where you're aligned as well. Why don't you run through that?
Right. So there's significant policy differences. So number one, he doesn't support Medicare for All. And he's not a co-sponsor on the Medicare for All Act. As I said, he's not a co-sponsor on the Citizens Over Corporations Amendment to overturn Citizens United. He's voted for increasing Trump's military budget to $1 trillion. And that's a vote that I would oppose. So Trump is coming back and he's asking for $1.5 trillion. Which is more military spending that has ever been deployed in this country. It's cost adjusted, it's higher than the World War II level spending. And so I actually think we have to pare back our Pentagon spending, not increase it. And so that's why I support, there's a bill in Congress now that would gradually cut Pentagon spending year after year if they continue to fail a federal audit. So the Pentagon's the only federal agency that consistently year after year, over the course of 8 years, they failed a federal audit. And so I think that's motivation to decrease the Pentagon budget.
All right. Are there other issues you disagree on?
Yeah, so there's a lot to choose from. Representative Auchincloss has voted in the past to increase the Department of Homeland Security budget. He voted to express gratitude towards ICE for protecting the homeland. Those are votes that I wouldn't have taken. Just this week, he voted on act called CORCA, which increases the power of DHS and ICE to collect surveillance, videos from retail stores, which ICE then can use to detain and deport undocumented citizens. And so Representative Auchincloss voted for CORCA. I would not have voted to expand the surveillance powers of ICE. Mm-hmm. There's another issue. Representative Auchincloss voted to continue or extend warrantless wiretapping under FISA. So FISA is the program in which the FBI can conduct surveillance, mass surveillance. And it picks up, it's supposed to be targeted, but it picks up data from everyday people, even if they're not suspected of a crime. Mm-hmm. And so the FBI is collecting this data on American citizens, and it's mostly without a warrant. And there was a vote to require a warrant for these types of surveillance, and Representative Auchincloss voted against the act that would have required the FBI to retain a warrant. And so that's another area which I disagree.
Are these votes where he's voting largely with the Democrats, or is he crossing over? How do his votes contrast to the bulk of the party? To Bernie Sanders, for example, say.
Yeah. So on the FISA vote, it was like split. So he was like one of the deciding votes to make it so the FBI didn't need a warrant for this type of surveillance. On the CORCA Act that just happened, I think this week, I think it was about 140 Democrats. So in the Pentagon spending bill, again, there was, I think it was about 50 or 60% of the Democratic caucus voted for it. There are representatives in Massachusetts that consistently are on the right side of these issues. I would point to Representative McGovern and Representative Presley. They voted against expanding Trump's military budget. They voted for requiring a warrant for the FISA searches. And they voted against this CORCA Act, which expanded the powers of ICE. And so when you look at these votes, those two representatives are often on the right side of these issues. Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, this year Israel is somewhat divisive in both parties. And I think on your website, you've alluded to some of those issues, maybe contrasting with the congressman. Any comments on that?
Yeah, so Congressman Auchincloss has voted for every supplemental spending bill transferring arms and military aid to Israel. Personally, I don't think that this country should be transferring arms to Israel. For the number one reason is because our own Leahy laws, and so the State Department has a law that says if a country is in violation of human rights, and there's been documented human rights abuses, that Israel has committed crimes against Palestinians and Lebanese people, that the United States should not be transferring aid to these countries. And the State Department has suppressed, I think, this evidence, but it's, you know, there are, you know, international court proceedings now against Israel. Mm-hmm. And even Benjamin Netanyahu right now is coming out and saying, you know, we don't want U.S. military aid anymore. We should phase it out. And so it's time to end, I think, this agreement in which the United States continues to spend billions of dollars for aid to Israel. Mm.
I think you've also mentioned PACs and some of the various support that that Congressman Auchincloss has received. Do you have any comments on that you want to cover?
Yeah, so he's received over $1 million in APAC contributions since he was elected to office in 2020. And so I would just say that, you know, I think there is a causal link in receiving the support and kind of the steadfast support to Israel. So APAC APAC's policy positions are not separable to the positions of the Israeli government.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's, you know, a problem if our representatives are receiving contributions, substantial contributions from a political action committee that has, you know, essentially identical policy mm-hmm. positions to those of a foreign government.
Are there other PACs? I think you had mentioned other PACs.
So there's
donations from.
So DMF. So the whole constellation. So mm-hmm. there's DMFI. So it's kind of like the democratic version of APAC. There's one called NORPAC, which is like the Republican version, which Representative Auchincloss has mm-hmm. also received from funds from. He's received funds from it's like the southern version of APAC, which is kind of like the right wing version, and that's you know, funded by individual who owns sporting rifle companies in the south, which I found very ironic because Representative Auchincloss is pro gun control, but he's receiving money from contributors who sell rifles.
Hmm. All right. I guess just a final question. I guess where would you put yourself on kind of the political spectrum? Mm-hmm. You know, if Congress Auchincloss probably would characterize himself towards the center, mm-hmm. he's actually leading a caucus or a group on that front. In that spectrum from center to highly progressive, where would you put yourself on that spectrum? Is there anything on the left or the farther left that you would see as too far relative to your positions?
Mm-hmm. So I'm running a campaign that's on the progressive left,
mm-hmm.
and you could also characterize it as the populist left.
Mm-hmm.
And so Medicare for All is, you know, our rallying cry. And so this is the number one thing for us, because we live in a system where people can't afford their the medication they need mm-hmm. to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And so and if I can comment on Representative Auchincloss's group, Majority mm-hmm. Democrats, so mm-hmm. there was also a reporting a few weeks ago by the Lever News about this, and Majority Democrats is running this constellation of PACs and nonprofits. One is called the Searchlight Institute, which is a kind of a policy think tank. They have an outfit called the Bench, which is designed to help elect moderate or centrist Democrats, and they have a consultancy group, and all these groups are funded by just a handful of billionaires. So the Mindells, for instance. And there are consultants that work across these entities. And there are campaign consultants who work in these entities and in the campaigns that they're advising. And so this is like a serious breach of our already weakened campaign finance regulations. And mm-hmm. so I think there has to be serious attention paid to the way that Democrats are running in these Democratic primaries, and the funding and the infrastructure that they're running on.
All right. Jason, thank you for everything we've covered. Anything else you'd like to cover before we wrap up?
I don't know. I think that's it.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Jason. The Democratic primary is September 1st. This has been the Fig City News podcast. I'm Jack Pryor. Thanks for listening. You can find more information at figcitynews.com.
Thank you, Jack.
Thank you.